basis. Glenn Beck is a racist. Gaza Strip was getting bombed. Obama didn't say shit. After you divorce yourself from the right-wing propaganda campaign, it's all simple and plain. America can stand the game. Your president got an African name. Now who you gon' blame? When they drop the bombs out of them planes, using depleted uranium. Babies looking like two-headed aliens. Follow the money trail that leads to the criminal. And nothing subliminal to it. That's how they do it. See the game they run. Give a fuck if he's cunning, articulate, and handsome. Afghanistan held for ransom by the hand of this black man. Neo-colonial puppet. White power with a black face. He said, oh, a master of disguise, expert at telling lies. Then they gave him a Nobel Peace Prize. Should've known he was trained in Chicago. Word to Chairman Fred and Mark Clark. What they do in the dark will come out in the light, like a WikiLeaks site. So I guess Nkrumah was right. Who's ready to fight? Last stage of imperialism, I ain't kidding. In the immortal words of Marvin Gaye, this ain't living. Strip was getting bombed, Obama didn't say shit.
OBAMA, you ain't fooling everyone, I see the games you play. Use VIP at the BIC, and we know that's a code name for CIA. Hey, hey, the same way your cameras are watching us, we're watching you. Think we're easy to control, you ain't got a clue. Revolution's on the way, let's see what you're gonna do. You're gonna send the troops, you're gonna drop the news. See, it's not where you're from, it's where you're at. He's sitting in the White House, so who cares if he's black? And why is there soldiers still out there in the back? Natural resources ain't yours, it's theirs, give it back. You're just another puppet, but I'm not surprised. Look at Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. They didn't change ish, how they think it's fresh off the slave ship. You all burn in hell, even Michelle Obama nation.
Strip was getting bombed, Obama didn't say shit.
What's the bigger threat from Osama or from Obama? Military bases from Chagos to Okinawa. I say things that other rappers won't say, cause my mind never closed like Guantanamo Bay. Hope you didn't build a statue or tattoo your arm, cause the drones are still flying over Pashtunistan. Did he defend the war?
No.
He extended more, even had the time to attempt a coup in Ecuador. Morales and Chavez, the states are on the hunt for ya. Military now stationed on bases in Colombia. Take a trip to the past and tell him I was right. Ask Ali Abu Nima and Jeremiah Wright. Drones over Pakistan, Yemen and Libya. Is Obama the bomber getting ready for Syria? First black president, the masses were hungry. But the same president just bombed an African country like...
That is Obama Nation with M1 featuring Lowkey and M1 featuring another artist who I can't quite recall. You're listening to Radio Basics on CHOY 105.5 FM. For our feature interview tonight, we have on the line with us Mahdi Darius Nazemroya, a research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization, or globalresearch.ca, which is an independent research and media institute organization based out of Montreal, and if I may say, one of the world's leading sources of news and analysis on geopolitics. Nazemroya is also a sociologist and an award-winning writer specializing on the Middle East and Central Asia, with numerous contributions to Al Jazeera, Russian television, and Press TV. Nazemroya was also on the ground in Libya reporting live for multiple media outlets as NATO conducted its merciless bombing campaign of that country's civilians and infrastructure. Nazemroya has published numerous pieces on the geopolitics of the looming U.S. war against Iran, which is the topic of our conversation tonight. Mahdi Darius Nazemroya is on the line with us now. Mahdi, thanks a lot for being on the show with us.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So, you know, we just had that track from Lowkey cover the geopolitics of many of the other countries that U.S. imperialism is waging war on. But now we must turn to Iran, which is a theater of war that seems to be getting very hot. And it's hardly been a year since the world stood witness to the brutal NATO campaign in Libya. And here we are, like less than 6 months later, and we see the escalation of tensions, diplomatic maneuvers, and war games being taken with Iran. Can you just provide, you know, you've done a lot of research on this, and if I may say, like incredibly detailed research. Can you provide our listeners with just some background to U.S. and Israel's preparations for war with Iran, which I understand has been some time in the making now.
All right. Well, first of all, these preparations have been ongoing. It's been well around a decade that plans for attacking Iran have been in place. I'm going to refer to General Wesley Clark, who was the head of the United States European Command, also the head of the armed forces of NATO. He was the Supreme Allied Commander Europe, as the formal title for NATO's commander is. In 2001, he said that after September 11th, that the Pentagon had decided to attack the following countries after Afghanistan: Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, I think I just mentioned Syria, and finishing off with Iran. Iran would be the last target. Every single country I just listed has been attacked by the United States, either covertly or overtly.
Or diplomatically, they help split Sudan into two countries.
Yes, exactly. In Lebanon, there's been an intensive war. Yeah. Ongoing, even after 2006, an intelligence war. We see the state of Syria now. Iraq was invaded. So this has happened. And Iran was the last piece for this campaign. They've been sending arms and weapons into the region, to the Gulf Cooperation Council, specifically Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They've been sending weapons to the Israelis. For years, they sent the bunker busters, the Israelis, to the Israelis just before 2006. In fact, Seymour Hersh, one of the best journalists in the United States, mainstream journalist in the United States, he said that the war on Lebanon was a preparation to attack Iran. It was a test run. And they were defeated in Lebanon, and this delayed things. In fact, the war in Lebanon was also supposed to expand into Syria, Iran's ally.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It didn't because of the Israelis' blunder there.
The Hezbollah completely destroyed, repelled the Israeli incursion.
Yes, it did. And it also, very importantly, damaged an Israeli warship, with one of their missiles, offshore missiles. So if Hezbollah, which is a small group, could do this, imagine what the Iranians, who trained and helped create Hezbollah, could do. And this made them pause. Iran's missile arsenal has also made them pause, but the war has been ongoing in many ways. There's been a diplomatic front. Let's start with how they said the Iranians have supported the Taliban. They said the Iranians were helping kill American troops in Iraq through roadside bombs. Then there's the wipe Israel off the map myth. It's a play with words. The president of Iran,
the mistranslation of Yakhmadinejad's speech.
It's a very deliberate mistranslation of the speech. Like, if you listen to the whole speech, you would say that can't make sense. So, this was not faulty translation. It was deliberately concocted. Even Obama's conference on nuclear nonproliferation said that the United States reserves the rights to use nuclear weapons against countries that are suspected or are breaching the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and that means North Korea and Iran. So they've been putting every type of story into place, including most recently the Saudi ambassador story, where the Iranians try to use the Mexican drug cartel to assassinate the Saudi ambassador. First he was at his home, then he went to a restaurant, and the story switched, and they took it to the United Nations for a vote. They didn't get the kind of support they wanted because there was countries that didn't vote, and there was countries that abstained. And the countries that did vote, it was about 100 countries that voted for the resolution. But I got to tell you, a lot of these countries were like Micronesia, like little islands the United States controls, which in
neo-colonies of the U.S.
Yes, exactly. In numerical terms, they really don't make the international community at all. Now Iran is being called a threat because of the IAEA's latest report, which was utterly politicized. It broke all the IAEA's regulations and rules. It took old faulty evidence like the laptop, which contained designs and was actually dismissed by the IAEA. And you know what? The IAEA on the record has said that the United States has falsified information a few years ago. So the new director general, former Japanese diplomat, he released a new report. And before he released the report, which he's supposed to release to all members of the IAEA, and he gave it to certain members who started, like, before everybody else, breaking regulations, started making a draft on the basis of this. You know, he also gave all the names of the Iranian nuclear scientists and people working in the energy program. Mm-hmm. He publicized that list, which, fully knowing well that there would be assassination attempts against them. And the war theater has started, because it is a covert war, and the assassinations in Iran and the terrorist attacks against military officials. Yeah,
there's been a couple of facilities where there's been major explosions in the past 2 months.
Yes. And, you know, we're not sure about some of them, but mm-hmm. it's very likely that they were attacked. And for sure, nobody can deny what's been happening to the nuclear scientists. Even before that, kidnapping of an Iranian general was kidnapped. There's the attacks on Iran's border areas in eastern Iran, in the province of Sistan-Baluchistan, which borders Pakistan and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. There's been terrorist attacks by a group called Jundullah, which, if you study, really does not represent the ethnic Baluch population of there, who are Iranian ethnic group. And there's also some Kurdish groups. There's been attacks in the provinces of Khuzestan, which is predominantly Arab. And the United States has been doing anything it could to upset Iran domestically and rise ethnic tensions. In fact, spies were arrested in the last few months tied to the CIA and Mossad, who were deliberately planning on upsetting the upcoming elections by doing whatever they could, by alleging fraud, hurting people, you know, making both sides go against each other. There's more than both sides in Iran, but I mean, making different parties, creating internal animosity in the country. So they have been trying to make the country implode, because I'm going to tell you very frankly, militarily, a war with Iran would be extremely costly for the United States and its allies. The United States would not be able to win a conventional war. That's why the biggest fear in this conflict is, in these tensions, is that the war is going to become unconventional, meaning nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction could be used by the United States. That's why in the last decade, the U.S. has been steadily trying to normalize the use of nuclear weapons and trying to legitimize their use, you know, saying that we would have no choice on using nuclear weapons, or talking about the tactical nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are nuclear weapons at the end of the day. But this is the only way that they can win a war, is in unconventional terms. A conventional war for the United States is unwinnable in regards to Iran. Yes, the United States militarily is the number one power in the world. But in a defensive war against Iran, where Iran's protecting its turf and the periphery around Iranian territory, a conventional war doesn't seem to be something the United States can win, unless it goes on a full-out unconventional war using every means it has possible at its disposal. There's also the threat of expansion of this war, turning it into a world war. The Russians and the Chinese, in different ways throughout the last decade, have made it clear that they can't accept a war against the Iranians.
And this is an issue I really want you to expand on. You know, I think that anybody who has had their eyes open, who has turned on the news once or twice in the last couple months, can see that there is these tensions that are escalating, seem to be moving towards a war, especially with how fast we saw the execution of the war against Libya play out. It's very clear that there is intentions for war here. So yeah, let's talk about the strategic interests right now of U.S. imperialism and also Israel, which they may be somewhat different with this war against Iran. Why do they want this war?
Okay, well, the Israelis are and the Americans, their strategies are aligned. They both have some variances, but it's predominantly aligned and streamlined. The Israelis in Washington's scheme of things, are the regional hegemon of the Middle East, or they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be America's gendarme or vanguard in the Middle East, an extension of the United States. You know, I'm not going to get into the does the tail wag the dog or does the dog wag the tail.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that geostrategically, both their policies are aligned. You know, and Israeli leaders have said it recently, and so have U.S. leaders. And the biggest challenge to their control in the Middle East is the Iranians. The Iranians are supporting the Syrians. The Iranians support the resistance movements. They supported the resistance movements in Lebanon and the various Palestinian groups, including the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Hamas. Specifically Hamas, the biggest one of them all. The Iranians are gaining in Iraq. You know, in Iraq could, in the next few years, you could see it as a staunch Iranian ally who might even refuse specific agreements with the United States. And we're beginning to see some of that coming into play. But the biggest issue right now is energy. And controlling energy routes, and this is directly tied to the Chinese and to an extent the Russians. You know, the Chinese are this is part of the American competition with China. You know, controlling energy routes means you have a leash around the Chinese, and Iran is the second biggest exporter of oil after Saudi Arabia in OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting States.
Yeah.
Not only is it the second right now, it still has more oil reserves than the Caspian. And, you know, it has a lot of oil. Plus, it is the number two country for gas in the world, natural gas. Put these things together and you have an energy superpower right there and a very lucrative price. You know, after the Russians, they have the second most gas. And, in fact, the Iranians and the Russians have created an OPEC-like cartel with countries like Qatar for natural gas as well. And natural gas in this coming century, in the next century, is going to be the main source of energy, a lot of people say. So this is a very lucrative prize. And the United States not only wants to control the oil and the energy, it wants to also direct it. It doesn't just mean that it wants it all for itself. It means it can prevent it, play with the prices. It can strategically use it against countries like China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something I'm wondering about. Like, would Iran be able to resist the military pretensions of the United States were it not for its, you know, backings of its major strategic partners, Russia and China? I understand that, I believe, I'm not mistaken, Iran is an observer right now within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Yes, it is, and there's a deliberate reason. Now, I want to say something about the Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians. Yeah. These are the three main countries opposing the United States in the world. They are the big three. Their coalition in Eurasia is what Brzezinski called an anti-hegemonic coalition. And he said that this is the worst strategic nightmare for the United States, is the creation of a Russian-Chinese-Iranian coalition, which is what's been happening. Mm-hmm. You know, the Iranians are integrating their security structure with the Russians. The National Security Council of Russia and the Supreme Security Council of Iran have made agreements on sharing information now. Every day you see more and more agreements between the Russian Federation and Islamic Republic Iran. In regards to China, the Chinese have a very good relationship with the Pakistanis, and they use Pakistan to create a geopolitical wall against India and to contain it. You know, but they also use Pakistan as a connection to Iran. there's been reports now that several thousand Chinese troops have entered Pakistan. I haven't verified them, but the sources are Pakistani, mm-hmm. and they're saying that the troops have entered Pakistan. And this means something, because the Chinese have also said that should there be a war, we will use Pakistan to reinforce the Iranians. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that one of the directors of the National Defense University or College of the People's Republic of China, who's a revolutionary general in the Chinese military, has stated without reservation that Beijing will not hesitate to go to war with the United States if it attacks Iran. That is how close the ties are between them.
And it also seems to suggest how important that strategic relationship is in Iran, based around the export of Iran's oil. Earlier in the show, in the headlines, I touched upon, I briefly touched upon AFRICOM's expansion in Africa and how that has to do with U.S. imperialism preempting the consolidation of Chinese interests on the continent. In a world where U.S. imperialism has been hegemonic for the last 60, 70 years, where the U.S. can, without reservation, attack, invade any country, assassinate anybody it wants with no sanctions and, without flinching, in that world, it has been very difficult for China and Russia to even move beyond their own status quo, right? They're at this strategic disadvantage where any military actions that they would be conducting as I think powers that have their own pretensions of creating small empires for themselves, certainly nothing that compares to the U.S. imperialism's hundreds and hundreds of military bases around the world. However, the question I'm getting at here is how ready are Russia and China, how ready are they to actually defend their strategic interests in Iran, whatever those interests may be? How ready are they to actually go to war with the Western imperialists over this important, piece of the strategic puzzle?
Well, that's an outstanding question to ask, and I'm glad you've asked it. And I want to rephrase it as not just Iran. Their strategic interests are more broader than Iran now, because it's their lifeline. Because if the Iranians fall, there goes one other connection for the Chinese for energy.
Yeah.
But it also opens the doorway into the heartland of Eurasia. It'll be over for the Russians. Well, if the Russians can't afford to see Iran fall or enter the orbit of the United States. If it does so, it is over for them in the former Soviet space. The Central Asia, the Caucasus, and the Caspian are open to the United States, and they can use Iran to easily take those countries out of the orbit of the United States because of its ethno-cultural, economic, and political ties to those countries.
Yeah.
It would be an opening to Russia's underbelly. But in regards to preparations, they've been preparing for years now, since 2000. And I'll start with one example here that should be very relevant to the listeners. Russian jets have systematically been flying into North American territory for the last few years. Several instances. This cannot be a mistake. It's testing NORAD's air defenses in case anything happens. They've been holding drills for World War-like scenarios, just like how the United States has been doing. The Chinese have been developing technology to combat the United States. They're expanding their naval presence. All of these three countries are also expanding their military presences. The Iranians, as everybody knows, in the last 2 months, they've been breaking out into the deep sea from the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman. Before the last year, they entered the Mediterranean, which is something that didn't happen in before 1979. It happened during the time of the Shah, but this is the first time since 1979 that they've been expanding. The Chinese have tested missiles that can target satellites, something that shocked the United States and angered it, when they shot down one of their old missiles as a message to the United States. These countries have been drilling and preparing for a World War scenario. They're very well prepared. And it's not just about Iran, because they are going to be targets,
So it's not just about Iran, but what you're saying is Iran is really this fault line for all of these the inter-imperialist contradictions between East and West right now?
If Iran is where the buck is going to end, you know, it's going to stop. They are not going to let if Iran should fall, then they are the next targets. There is nothing that is between them and the United States. Now, the reason why they've supported sanctions, for example, is because the Iranians are very independent, just like how the Chinese and the Russians are independent from one another. They're not clients of the Russians or the Chinese. And the Chinese and Russians have only supported sanctions in the past on the calculation that it would bring Iran closer to them or to their orbit by letting the West create barriers between itself and Iran, so Iran can't trade with them and instead trades with Russia, China, former Soviet republics, Asia, etc. So they've supported sanctions in that context, but they will never support sanctions that will actually hurt Iran at all, because it's against their interests, and they're not going to support the upcoming unilateral sanctions being pushed by Canada, the United States, and the European Union. And since we are mentioning Canada...
Yes, on that point, my final two questions were actually, how do the EU and Canada, both of which are, you know, imperialist powers in their own right, how do they fit into this?
Well, the European Union has its own interests. What it's doing with Iran, you know, they passed the so-called oil embargo.
Yeah.
They've passed it, but they're not implementing it, because they can't implement it right away. They might steadily streamline it and flirt with it. I'm telling you that a lot of the pressure being put on Iran is also psychological in many aspects, too. Mm-hmm. And the Europeans cannot afford a straight-cut oil embargo right away, even though they said they passed the resolution and the press has parroted this. But in action, in practice, it hasn't come into effect, and it'll take some time. Canada and most of the EU will be partners in any conflict against Iran. The United States is pushing them into this. Peter McKay, you know, he's come out with statements saying that if there's a war in Syria, we'll be there.
Yeah.
If there's a war in Iran, we'll be there. We're making plans. And this is when Canada's buying new weapons shipments.
Yep.
Stephen Harper has called Iran the biggest threat in the world, you know. So we're becoming cheerleaders in this war, and we will be active participants, just like how we were in the war in Libya.
Yeah.
We're a Canadian...
leading participants, yeah.
Leading participants, that's right. A Canadian flag officer was in charge of the campaign from the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
You know, so Canada's role in this war will be, I'm not going to say important, but there'll be an existing role for Canada, and we have a government in power that wants to be a junior partner or a client of the United States in these imperialist wars. But once again, this war is not going to be like a war against Iraq. It's not going to be like a war against Afghanistan or Libya. The Iranians have full military capabilities. They have not flinched in the face of the United States. You know, they've taken down the U.S. drone, while countries like Pakistan, you know, can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
You know, while Turkey can't stop Israeli drones over it. But the Iranians are a very hard shell. And if there's a war with the Iranians, you're going to see global ramifications of a very terrible war that Canadians will feel. We will feel it in every single way, politically, economically. You know, the Canadian casualties if we send troops there.
I'm gonna have to leave it there just because we have another interview tonight.
Okay.
But you know, people can follow your work at globalresearch.ca. You've been covering a lot of the topics in the from the Middle East and Central Asia. We thank you so much for your work, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor.
Have a good night.
Bye.
That was Mahdi Darius Nazamroya from globalresearch.ca. We're going to go to a commercial break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to the local CAW local president, Local 27 president, Tim Carey, about the lockout of Caterpillar workers in London, Ontario. Stay tuned. Radio Basics. We'll be back.
You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM. Broadcasting at 158 watts at 105.5 FM. On the World Wide Web at chry.fm. And on the Rogers Digital Network, channel 945.
At the top of our show today in the headline news, we were talking about the Caterpillar workers out in London, Ontario, who have been locked out since January 1st after the expiration of their contract. The company Electromotive Diesel, a subsidiary of Caterpillar, locked them out of work for not accepting more than 50% wage concession, as well as concessions to their pension plans and benefits. On the line with us now is Tim Carey, the president of Local 27 and the Canadian Auto Workers. Tim, thanks for being on the line with us tonight.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You know, I'm a union member, too, up here at York at QP3903, and I know what it's like to go through a strike, or in your case, a lockout, and certainly not have the corporate media on your side. So to begin our discussion today, I just wanted to give you an open mic here to tell us, you know, basically give our listeners a context, a brief synopsis on how the workers of Electromotive Diesel have ended up locked out and what exactly the employer is asking for.
Well, it goes right back to when Caterpillar purchased this plant back in June of 2010. And we started bargaining with them in June of 2011, where they tabled a proposal at that point in time that slashed our wages by over half, slashed benefits, eliminated the defined pension plan, pretty well every aspect of the collective agreement. And so at that point in June of 2011, they also said, take this, or we'll give you an extension until the end of December, and we could work under the same wages and benefits that we enjoyed at that time. We accepted that, and we went back in again in November. Basically, the same proposal was on the table again. And then in December, late December, they modified it one little bit in regards to the wage from 35. In June, it was from 35 to 14.50, and they modified that from 35 to 16.50 an hour. And obviously, again, as they knew from all along, it was a proposal we couldn't accept.
Yeah, so you make an outrageous demand, then you budge an inch to make it look like you're bargaining in good faith, whereas it's outrageous to begin with. You know, some people are speculating, I can't remember where I read this in the last day or two, but some are speculating that this is really just an attempt to shut down the plant, put the ball in your court to make it look like it's your fault for asking for too much, and to move operations to places where they have non-unionized workers.
Well, they do have a non-unionized facility in Muncie, Indiana, but if their plan was to make it look like it was our fault, I would argue they miserably failed on that. You know, I've been involved in labor relations and issues for over 25 years, and I've seen my share of disputes. But what I haven't seen in my history is the amount of support outside the labor movement for the stand that we're taking. That has been something that I believe the message here in regards to cutting wages in half, just as an example, is resonating with the ordinary citizen of London and, quite frankly, across the country. I've laid it out there that, you know, your employer who's profitable, and as we know, this employer is very profitable, comes to you at the end of the year, whether you work there or whether you work in a restaurant, and says, you know, Jane, I made a lot of money last year, but you know what? I need to buy a Cadillac, so I want half of your wages. That's basically the same premise here, and I think Canadians reject that, and they especially reject a company coming in from the U.S. like Caterpillar, purchasing this plant and attacking our community. That's what's resonating here, and actually, in some ways, they've woken up a lot of people.
You know, some may call this corporate greed, but, you know, what we've seen in the last few years in this so-called age of austerity is a unilateral attack by employers, by big capital on labor, where despite how profitable these companies are, they're accumulating greater and greater profit margins, and what they seem to be doing with those profit margins is consolidating their power all across the world, you know, buying up firms just like Electromotive was bought up by Caterpillar. You know, these companies are doing this all across the world. So my question to you is, you know, what strategy does the labor movement have to actually beat back these attempts, which are, you know, the struggle is international. It seems like we're definitely on the losing side right now. Is there a strategy of the labor movement to actually fight back against this?
Well, I think the labor movement has to unite, for one thing, it has to unite across the country and across the province. As we may know, there's been some problems within the labor movement itself, which, you know, unfortunately has been there, and whether it's the reasons for it, I won't get into, but I think something like this galvanizes the labor movement. But we can't stop there. We've got to recognize that we're dealing with the whole world here, not just Canada.
Yeah.
And we have to organize and we have to work in solidarity with the trade union movement and with other groups outside the trade union movement, youth groups, the Occupy group, which, by the way, is at our picket line. I've set up tents at our picket line. I've been there to help us, and this is the outreach I think that we have to have, recognizing that this fight is such a visual fight around a whole issue that Occupy raised around the 99%, and I think we have to continue to do that.
And do you think at this point, do you see that strategy or that strategic horizon within the labor movement? Is it growing? Is it developing?
Yes, I do. I see that. I see the outreach with the groups outside of bargaining. I see that this has woken up a lot of people that said, you know, you're absolutely right that the employers have had it good now for a while. While they scream and yell, the economy's in trouble. CEOs are making more in a half a day than the average worker in a year. All of these such blatant injustices are being highlighted. And it's all coming at the same time that Caterpillar is doing this in London. So it's raising all sorts of issues about the growing gap between the rich and the poor, the elimination of the middle class that we'll argue is based on, you know, the whole income level. But all of that is under attack. And I think that Canadians, and I know in London, people are seeing it.
And just briefly before we finish, you said that the outpouring of support has been unprecedented. Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, let me give you just a couple examples. We had a dentist that stopped by the picket line last week to say how he supported our struggle and handed over a check for $1,000.
Wow.
We had the Sisters of St. Joseph, which is a group here in London, nuns, at our picket line serving soup. You know, so it just spans across, you know, charity groups, and like I say, the Occupy group. So it's resonating with all sorts of people in London that believe in justice and better treatment for all. So you know what? I think Caterpillar underestimated the fight back here.
And what seems to be on the horizon for the struggle? Is there any budging in negotiations and bargaining? Or
no, there's no budging whatsoever. We're not sure what their agenda is. As I've said to others, it's either one, that they think they can beat down the membership here to accept this offer, and I can assure you that's not going to happen, or they don't intend to make locomotives. But if that happens, now we have to say to the government, how can you let something like this happen? How can you let a corporation come in, buy up a facility, and take our jobs away? Stephen Harper's got to say our jobs are not for sale.
Yeah. Do we have any sign that the Harper government cares more about jobs than, you know, corporate profit margins?
Absolutely not. Yeah. It's been very frustrating. There's been other MPs, the NDP MP, Irene Matheson, on the line with us provincially. An NDP MP, but when it comes to the Conservatives, they have not been seen on the line, and they certainly refuse to vocally at least say what Caterpillar is doing is immoral.
Yes. Tim, thank you so much for being on the line with us, and you know, all the power to you guys in your struggle. You know, Basics, we're going to be out at the picket lines later this week, and we hope to get into this a little bit more.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for listening to our story.
Definitely, Tim. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
All right, good night. That was Tim Carey, the Local 27 president of Canadian Auto Workers. He was talking to us about the locked out workers out in London, Ontario, at the Electromotive Diesel plant, which is a subsidiary of Caterpillar. That's pretty much all we got for Radio Basics tonight. I had one topical track that I wanted to play. It's from a group, Canadian group called the Consumer Goods. I was looking them up here on MySpace today, and I know it indicates that they're a band out of Winnipeg, but I happen to know one of the lead members. Just saw him on York University campus today, so I'm not really sure where they're from. I know they're in Toronto often. So the track is called Hockey Night in Afghanada, and I just want to offer a couple of disclaimers here. One, because there is a bit of expletives. There are a couple expletives in this track, curses, profanity, whatever you want to call it, which I think is justified by the content. It's poetically justified. It's a little poetic license taken by the artist here to state a point, some important points. You know, the track deals with, as you'll see, Canadian culture and militarism and war, and it's called Hockey Night in Afghanada. And second, the second justification I would make for the expletives in this track, which are neither gratuitous nor ignorant, and I would argue not even profane. This track, you know, which references one of CBC Radio's flagship shows, Afghanada, that show, which is, you know, promotes militarism, I believe, by, you know, one-sidedly humanizing the troops who are occupying and conquering Afghanistan and giving very little voice to the people, the civilians who are on the other side, the receiving end of that occupation. So Afghanada, CBC Radio's, one of CBC Radio's flagship shows, which gives, I believe, 10 or 11 in the morning on weekdays or some weekdays. I don't really listen to it. I just come across it from time to time. I think has more profanity in the show than probably any other show on the radio I often hear. So I think if they can take that license to promote military propaganda, I think we can take a bit of license to promote some anti-militaristic, anti-imperialist propaganda, call, if you will. This is the Consumer Goods Hockey Night in Afghanada.
Fucked on cherry, there I said it. How long are we gonna let it be okay to turn hockey skates into recruitment gates for the army? Beautiful boys on the screen, white faces shaved so smooth and clean. Noble hearts in the noble arts of war and occupation. There's nothing about pucks and nets, skates on ice, sticks on skin that says it's okay if some brown person loses a limb. There's nothing about Ron McLean, the CBC hits from behind and say it's alright to bomb a few foreigners from the sky. On a foreign stage, the only leaf I see is losing 6-3, and that's fine with me. Oh, I know. It seems a harmless thing as we stand and sing, but in Afghanistan, it's another thing. There's no peace to keep when you ride up in a jeep and you blow the bleep out of some children. There's nothing about pucks in nets, skates on ice, sticks on skin that says it's okay if some brown person loses a limb. There's nothing about Ron McLean, the CBC hits from behind and say it's alright to bomb a few foreigners from the sky.
shooting star.